Okay. My name is Tiffany Gerber, and I'm here interviewing Carol Fairbanks on March 16th, 2009 at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire in the Wage Center. Start with our first question, some background information. Okay, so first question is, what is your race?
Anglo-Caucasian.
And do you know your ancestry or ethnicity?
Yeah, Fairbanks family came in 1636.
Wow.
And the other side of my family, the Hunts, came sometime early 17th.
Okay.
So I don't have any interesting background.
How many male and or female siblings do you have?
One brother.
One brother, okay. So in your birth order in the family, are you oldest or youngest?
I'm younger.
All right. And let's see. How many children do you have?
Three sons.
Okay. And any grandchildren?
Four.
Four. Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Fun. And where did you attend school, and what degrees have you earned?
Okay. I started at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. I intended right from the start to just go for 2 years, and then I was getting married. And he'd already been picked out. After the 2 years at Cornell, I transferred to Syracuse University while my husband was getting his master's degree. Then when he took a job in Flint, Michigan, and also went to school for his PhD, I took courses at Syracuse University. And somewhere along there, I had a son, yes. And then when we moved to Michigan, and I finally got my bachelor's degree at the University of Michigan. Then when we moved to Eau Claire, he was teaching in the geology department, and for the first year, the English department had developed a master's in English, so I got my master's here at Eau Claire.
Okay.
And then a PhD from Minnesota in American Studies. Ooh, early 80s.
Sure.
Maybe like 84 or so.
Okay, great. Is there anything else about your general background that you think would be important for us to know?
Well, I grew up in rural New York, upstate New York, but Cornell was 18 miles away. One of the state educational schools was maybe 15 miles away, Ithaca College. Syracuse was maybe 50 miles away. And I had parents who made sure we took advantage of all those different possibilities. So though I grew up on a farm, I probably had a fairly enlightened youth.
Sure. Okay. going from that, we'll kind of going to stories from childhood and adolescence. Can you describe your relationship with your parents and siblings when you were growing up?
Well, until I was in high school, my father was farming, and so he was always there. There was always the sense of someone being nearby. Unlike children today, I could roam a mile in any direction, and nobody worried about what was happening to me. It was a very comfortable situation. If there were attacks on children, we certainly didn't hear about them, so it just wasn't an issue. My mother taught school beginning when I was probably fourth or fifth grade, and so I had that connection with the school. Our town had 500 people.
Okay.
And when I graduated, there were 15 of us in my graduation class.
Sure.
So, it wasn't hard to be valedictorian.
Sure.
And I went from there to Cornell and was part of a class of, I don't know, 2,000, I suppose.
How was that transition for you?
I had to learn how to study because in high school, you know, if you were a conscientious student, paid attention, did the readings, fine.
Mm-hmm.
It was much more demanding, and at the end of my first semester, I told my parents that I just didn't belong there. And when the second semester started, I was still there. My parents were sure I would do just fine. And I discovered there were other students in the dorm who were not still there. And during that second semester, I gained confidence and figured out that I would be just fine.
Sure. Okay. Can you tell me a little bit more about the community in the neighborhood or area where you did grow up and how your family was involved with the community?
Yeah, well, of course, my mother, being a teacher, was involved. And then when I was in high school, my brother had already started Cornell in architecture, and money was short, and my mother finally took over my dad's books for the farming and decided we were living on her teacher's salary, which was minimal in the early 1950s. And so he had to get another job, and he became manager of a bowling alley in King Ferry. And that was really, the bowling alley became one of the cultural centers of this little town. Mm-hmm. And there was a Masons group, a Masonic temple, and the reason I mentioned that is our high school science teacher and eventually principal was a Jew. And the only Jewish family in our town. And as I think back, I wonder why he ever came to this rural community. And when he decided to be part of the community, he joined the Masons, and half the membership dropped out because, but probably the most remarkable part of my childhood, about half a mile away, was a migrant camp. And in the summer, migrants would come in from Georgia, Alabama, and come in truckloads and pick beans. It was the era before the automatic bean pickers. And so every fall we had African American kids in the school. And one year when I was in high school, one of the young men, probably 16, 17 year old, stayed in the community and played basketball, the only African American in the whole conference at that time.
Sure.
And as a result of that experience, when I moved to Flint, I became active in the civil rights movement and taught courses in the high schools on African American history and art and literature.
Okay.
And so those early childhood experiences have an impact.
Mm-hmm. Was that when you speak of the science teacher who was Jewish,
mm-hmm.
And you saw that reaction with the Masonic mm-hmm. temple, was that your first experience with discrimination or oppression?
Yeah, and hearing my parents talk about the situation, I was fortunate that I had these two parents who were not prejudiced in any way. And in fact, my cousin who grew up next door became a lawyer in L.A. and was took a case to the Supreme Court and got promotions for African American police women in L.A. who had been discriminated against in terms of pay. And my uncle used to say, "I just don't know what's happened to Tom," because my uncle was prejudiced. And he said, "It must be that Harvard that did it." Well, it was growing up in a community where the other African-American kids were his friends, and he saw no difference. And mm-hmm. so he became a civil rights lawyer and, in fact, adopted an African-American child,
mm-hmm.
also a Lebanese child.
Okay.
And had one of his own. And so as far as prejudice in this little school, I wasn't aware of things going on. I'm sure there were, but I blissfully...
So it was just that one experience growing up?
Uh-huh.
Okay. so then, assuming it's an all-white community,
yes.
My next question would be, who had power and privilege in your community? How that affect you and your family? But I would assume...
Well, my mother's a teacher, I suppose, had influence. And in fact, she, when my brother started first grade, She was responsible for getting the grade split. They were running grades 1 and 2 together, and she was responsible for getting them separated so that there wasn't a classroom of 30 kids or something. Mm-hmm. So I grew up with this notion of political efficacy, that you could make things happen.
That's great.
And that you don't have to accept the situation as it is.
Wonderful.
And of course the ministers were in the community had influence, and there were a couple of families with money, probably pretty modest, mm-hmm. but there was the awareness that there were these two families that had more money than most of the families, and they, of course, were influential, Board of Education, that sort of thing.
Sure. Okay. What values did you learn from your family and other people and institutions within the community then?
Well, we've already covered the business of prejudices being a non-issue, but at the same time affecting all my research. My first two publications were books, African-American literature. In terms of values, we had a lot of women teachers, which is typical coming out mm-hmm. of that post-war era when the men had been off fighting the war and women moved into teaching jobs. So, and I had two aunts who also taught in the school. And so it was clear that women were valued. I don't have any insight into business world of that era. I was simply, living in a small town, wasn't mm-hmm. aware of. And back to your question, values. You were either Protestant or Catholic, and one of my brother's friends was Presbyterian, married a Catholic, and it was a big to-do. So that was one barrier in, I'd say at that point, mid-50s. Discrimination between the different religious groups. Suggestions?
Maybe on gender, growing up with your mom being a teacher, so she's already, outside of the home, but still in a very gender-specific role. Did you ever feel that your gender hindered you? You know what I mean? Couldn't do anything
right.
because you were a female, or that you had, a door that was wide open for you to go through?
It was not an issue. And it was never an issue for me. And part of it is through education. I just went to school whenever... I went to school nonstop, even though a lot of times when I was raising three sons, I was just taking a course a semester. But I think that stability of growing up in this little environment where girls could do anything they wanted to do, and yet I was the only one who went into college out of my class.
Mm.
So others probably because of... obviously, my family didn't have a lot of money living on my mother's salary, and then things got a little better when my dad moved off from the farm, although we still had all the chickens and the eggs and the garden and everything,
mm-hmm.
that we never left the farm. Where was I going with that?
With other women not continuing on with their education.
Yeah, so obviously there were restrictions. There probably weren't the scholarships. I don't know if... my best friend went to Cortland State for a week and dropped out and came back home. And so there was something not going on there.
Sure.
That probably, I'm sure, larger environment, there might have been more encouragement for girls.
Okay.
But as I say, I just drifted through, never feeling any kind of roadblock.
That's great.
One semester, we have, in New York, we have these regents exams, and you take the trial exam to see how well you will do on the actual test. And the principal, who was this Mr. Wiseman, the Jewish principal, he saw my score and he said, you can do a lot better than that. And he tutored me. He told my mother to have me come in after school for a few weeks too. And so he was certainly paying attention. But I think having a mother in the school, I got attention that other kids might not have gotten.
Sure. It's a little bit more of a privilege for you.
Yeah.
Okay. any memories from your childhood that continue to make a difference in your life?
Can you give me some examples?
Anything, I know in past interviews I focused a little bit more on discrimination that you might have seen.
Yeah.
So, I mean, with a Jewish teacher, but maybe anything with, you know, that migrant farm being so close and seeing different races and ethnicities being there just for a pure work purpose and nomadic.
Well, certainly those observations of watching the African-American women would wear blouses and skirts or dresses and then work pants underneath. And that was always touching to me, that they maintained their femininity by wearing those dresses, even though they were cumbersome. I mean, surely out in the fields they had to tuck them up so they could crawl along the rows. And I just always had enormous sympathy for them, although my mother would get to know some of the women, and they talk about that they had a home back in Alabama or Georgia, that they didn't live in somebody else's cabins all the time.
Sure.
And but it certainly made an enormous difference in my own development as a human being to observe the way some of the population lived as distinct from the way we lived. There was one family, the Barneses, who traveled behind a tractor and a wagon. The family rode in the wagon. And Dorothy would be brought to, her husband would bring her and the children to church. I went to a Presbyterian church. And they sat in one of the pews. Everyone shied away from them because of the odor. You know, they obviously had none of the facilities and none of the money to buy bare essentials. And my mother had gone to high school with this Dorothy, and my mother was always sympathetic to her. So I was really fortunate to have, as I said before, those parents who did not criticize or complain about how other people lived.
Were your parents involved in politics at all growing up?
No, not at all. They were Republicans. They had no business being Republicans. They should have been FDR supporters, but they weren't. And, of course, you know, in fact, my first election, I voted for Eisenhower, who ran on a Republican ticket. And it wasn't until Kennedy came along that I became, on my own, a Democrat.
Sure, okay.
In a small town like that, we never had any sense of the broader political perspective, like countywide issues. I just don't remember them being issues.
Sure.
Other than who was on the school board, I was completely unaware of the political situation.
Okay. anything else you might want to share about your childhood experiences that I didn't cover?
I had a lovely older brother, and I'm sure that made a big difference in terms of relationships with men. There was no antagonism. My father was a very gentle kind of man. When I was a senior, And my boyfriend, the guy that I eventually married, was going to St. Lawrence University. And he couldn't come home for the junior prom. And he had a geology conference he was participating in. And so I called my brother and asked him if he'd take me. And he did. Mm. And isn't that funny? It never would have occurred to me that would, after, what, 60 years, that would touch me. But I remember one of my friends saying, my brother would never have come home from school to take me to a dance. Mm-hmm. And so that was a very positive aspect.
Yeah. Wonderful. I'm happy that he did. That's great. Moving on from your childhood into crafting feminist identities, can you, we've already gone through your education, so let's see. When and how were you awakened to social inequalities based on gender, race, social class, and sexual orientation outside of your childhood experiences, so once you've left home?
In English programs at Cornell, Syracuse, and Michigan, we studied, thinking back through those courses, I think maybe as an undergraduate, we studied Jane Austen, and there were probably a few poets that we read, a few poems by women writers. And when I was finishing up my last year at University of Michigan, we had all men except for one course where we studied Virginia Woolf. And another course, I did a paper on Edith Wharton. And the professor said, oh, that's very interesting. He said, I've never read any of her books, but he said, I am aware of her. Well, of course, Edith Wharton was, you know, mm-hmm. in retrospect, a really big name. And in fact, as a faculty member, I remember sitting in the coffee room and one of the other English professors, a man, said, well, you know, if I were to integrate some women writers into my courses, who would they be? And, you know, there's a case of a man having gone straight through the PhD and never having studied a woman author. And so I don't know, you know, we used to talk about when the click happened. And I'm not sure in terms of my profession. I had one of my University of Michigan professors ask me what I was going to do after I got my bachelor's degree, and I said, I have no idea. And he said, you should consider being an English professor. Go on for straight through for PhD. I said, well, I've never had a woman professor. So from those three universities,
wow.
Never had. Until my master's program, when I got here at Eau Claire, I had two women professors. And I do remember sitting in the English department office waiting to see the department chair, and I knew which courses I had signed up for, only I only saw the last name. And I'm looking at the roster of faculty and realize that two out of three professors I was going to have were women, and it kind of took me back a bit because I had never, and you know, they discount, we went through a stage in women's studies where role models were really important. We went through another stage where, well, this role model thing can be discounted. It's not all that important. Well, it certainly was for me because I was finally able to piece together my undergraduate professor saying I should become an English professor, and then moving on to the master's degree and having two women professors who became very close friends. One of them died, but the other is still one of my closest friends. And so in terms of the academic situation, that was certainly a turning point for me.
Sure. You were speaking earlier outside of maybe your profession in the academic realm, becoming, you know, part of an activist in the civil rights movement. How did you get involved in with that?
When I was at, my husband was teaching while he was getting his PhD and while I was getting my, finishing my undergraduate degree from University of Michigan, he was teaching at Flint Community Junior College. And I, of course, joined the Faculty Wives Club. And one of the women, probably the only African-American woman in that club, was in charge of adult education. And somehow or other, she zeroed in on me as being a person to be mentored. And I started out working with her in the schools on art history. They have beautiful setup for the high school students. They studied the same period in history, literature, and I would come in with the art component. And then, because Flint, Michigan was 25% African American and also had a large Middle Eastern population, and the Board of Education, this my mentor was Marguerite Randall. They told her she needed to move into, in her programs, developing things on race. And also she worked with World Affairs. And she would tell me, okay, Carol, I want you to go into the schools and do a series of six programs on civil rights issues. I mean, I was starting from zero, and yet she just had this trust that I'd pull it off. And the first program I had to do, I still remember, and I said, you are going to be there, aren't you? She said, of course I am. Well, you know, she never showed up, and she had no intention of showing up. She had her own stuff to do. And so really, she was a major factor. And during those years, I read everything available in African American literature. There wasn't much in the early 60s. And so I started developing my expertise in African American literature from the early 60s on as kind of a parallel movement with my political development in the civil rights movement. And so my early publications were African American lit. When we moved to Eau Claire, by that time, 1969, there were African Americans getting degrees, becoming active in a broad variety of ways, you know, politically, in academia, getting degrees and beginning to teach in history, and literature was always a beginning point for a lot of people. And I could see that while I taught here in 71, I taught that semester, I taught three African American lit courses in 71. I could see that my work in African American studies was still important, and I continued publishing in that area. I also could see that maybe I had a larger role to take on in the feminist movement. And as I pointed out, I'd been subscribing to the Nickel Review out of Syracuse. I joined one of the early NOW groups here in Eau Claire, and you know, we had these consciousness raising groups which were very interesting, and I still remember one of my friends being in a group of five, and after a couple of years she said, I'm not going to do this anymore. I realize I'm the only one who's ever telling the truth in this consciousness raising group. And so they were an important part of identifying others And let's see, where are we at now? At some point I need to talk about the organization called Women in Higher Education.
Sure.
And should we
yep,
do that?
Yep, we can move right on into that and then go into the women's studies.
I had done my master's thesis on Ralph Ellison, an African-American writer. And the English department needed someone to teach these three extra sessions of African-American Lit. And so because of my background in Flint, Michigan, and because of my master's thesis, I was offered the job. And at a time when there were probably a dozen other people living here in Eau Claire who wanted to teach in the English department. But I got in with that kind of background. And I taught for one semester and then I was off. But during that one semester in 1971, they started organizing what we call Women in Higher Education. And we had, each university in the system had their local Women in Higher Ed. And then we had a network feeding into...
One moment. I'm sorry. You can keep going. I have to keep going on.
We had a network feeding into all of the... At that time, I think there were either 13 or 15 branches, the universities and then the two-year colleges. And come a Friday night, we'd pile into somebody's car and head off to one of the other campuses, or we'd host a group here. And the importance of that group, we would compare notes. We'd meet all day Saturday, and we would compare frustrations were a large part of it because of money and, the administrations didn't have the money to just hand over divisions, and it was difficult for each campus to make room for women's studies. In fact, one of the most difficult aspects of getting women's studies established on this campus, there was no place to put women's studies in the catalog. I mean, to look back, it seems absurd with a capital A.
Mm-hmm.
The English department said, okay, the intro to women's studies course can be housed in the English department. The administration the next morning, we got a call back saying, no, you can't do that. And so for about 2 years we were hung up simply because they wouldn't figure out, because there was no women's studies department mm-hmm. to put women's studies. There was just no place to put it. And that was one of the hurdles. We were the last campus to get a part-time women's studies coordinator. And I became women's studies coordinator, I think, in 1977. And it was quarter position. By then, all the other campuses had at least a quarter position, if not a half position. But while there was that problem with getting the Intro to Women course going, as I've always been research-oriented, and I have to say that our university library, believe it or not, there was money in those days for library resources. They started subscribing to the women's studies journals that were beginning to come out, and previous to that, they had been very supportive in terms of African-American journals. And as an individual researcher for 25 years, the university supported me in every way possible in terms of doing research through grants and library resources and travel. And so while we were having trouble in women's studies getting it started in some ways, there was still that basic support. Now in terms of developing courses, I still remember a very specific incident where by the mid-50s, we had what we called Women's Steering Committee. working locally. And we went to one department, and I'm not going to say which department. We went to one department where there was one woman in that department and asked her about developing a course in that department. English department had already, by that point, I think by 72, English department had a women's literature course. Sociology had a course going. I think there was a history department course that ran kind of sporadically through the 70s. But this other department, the woman said, I still picture sitting up straight, and she said, I have never had any trouble being a woman. And, you know, where had her head been? It was just really puzzling and frustrating that she couldn't get out of her own specific, like, I had never had any problem doing anything I wanted, but I could see a lot of other people around me having trouble, and girls growing up. And so there was that one very frustrating situation. But most of the academic departments were hiring a woman, maybe, for the first time in the faculty, and most of those were younger women coming out of the academic background who were interested in teaching women's courses, or else doing a lot of courses. The regular professors began integrating more women's materials into their courses.
Okay.
And so there were men and women in the faculty who were supportive. Something went through my mind there for a minute that I needed to mention. Well, maybe it'll come back to me.
Could we back up for a moment and maybe you could discuss briefly on who came together and how the topic first came about to have the Women's Studies Department, or program back then, developed on campus, how that sparked here.
We started in 71, we started as a very informal group of women, academic women, and we very soon started bringing in students who were interested. And I don't remember what the turning point was, that somebody said, okay, let's start getting together. And of course, along with what was happening here on campus, we became aware of what was happening in all the other campuses. And so it was not through any kind of administrative development. It was through individual women in a variety of departments all over the state saying we need to push for women's studies. And early on, I think by the mid-70s, we even got work study so that we had women students who were participating in doing research for faculty in different areas. When I became the coordinator in 77, and I was 77, 78, 79, I was coordinator until I took a leave of absence to go to Minnesota to finish my doctoral program. And I always had a work study student working on women's research.
Okay.
And we were a small group for quite a while. I had one major conflict with the Dean of Arts and Sciences when it was established that I had a grant to leave for a year to go back to school. He said about appointing the next women's studies coordinator. And I said, no, our steering committee is the one that's due. And so that's an example of the administration used to making decisions and being astonished that we weren't accepting those decisions, mm-hmm. that it had to be a coordinated effort. And as it turned out, the person he appointed was perfectly fine, but it was the principle of the thing.
Sure.
And I usually come across as a fairly individual who's cooperative and likes to get along. And so that, I think, was part of the problem, that he wasn't expecting this subordination from me. And I think that's probably a situation that was repeated all through universities across the country.
Sure. Having the Women's Studies program, you know, on campus then by the 70s, going through Sarah Harder's papers and looking through the issues just within the faculty and staff on campus and gender issues with pay and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Do you think having that Women's Studies program on campus brought about those issues more on more to the front lines or helped to support the women faculty?
Yes, because, you know, we're a relatively small university, and so there was a lot of overlapping that women who were, like, on the Women's Studies Steering Committee, mm-hmm. were also, like, Sarah became, what was her position, the hiring,
In human resources, or?
Well, it wasn't called, that's a more newer term, but, you know, equality, overseeing equality in pay and
sure.
that sort of thing. One of the earliest actions we took as a women's studies, and this would be in, spring of 72, we found out that the personnel, that's what made me think of the personnel director, sent out a notice to all the women and the staff, not professors, but all the women and the staff, secretaries, coordinators, those kinds, mm-hmm. could not wear pants. They had to wear dresses. And one of us on the steering committee got that piece of information, and so we as faculty members who were wearing whatever we wanted to wear, nobody had told us mm-hmm. what to wear, we set up an appointment to meet with the personnel director, and he had asked, secretary, I suppose, asked us why we wanted to meet with him, and we said it's about the policy that women have to conform to a certain dress code. And by the next morning, he had canceled the meeting and had retracted his statement. And so, you know, it's just a very little thing, but...
It's not.
And so there was that very satisfactory kind of situation that occasionally we were able to make a change. One of my frustrations was, Eau Claire, I don't know what the tenor is now, but we were a very conservative school, and I don't know if you would still characterize it in that way, but we didn't have a big push from students to get women's studies, where some of the other camps, certainly Madison and Milwaukee, had a solid student body pushing for change.
That's how it seemed, just going through the files in the archives, which is why I brought up, you know, I mean, it was a lot more focused on the issues faculty were going through.
Yeah.
Within this university and, you know, taking that and looking on a bigger scale.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you can definitely notice going through archives the lack of the student voice there until probably... I don't even know. I haven't gotten past 1979 yet. So. but
I don't think we had a man take our women's studies course in literature until late 70s. And then any of us teaching those courses, you know, whether sociology, anthropology, political science, we get one or two or three students for several years. What is it now?
For the women's studies? I actually, unfortunately, have never taken a women's studies course here, so I wouldn't be able to say for classroom size. Yeah. But I know that men have been getting a little bit more involved. An individual that we were just talking about is, I don't know if Justin, I cannot think of his last name, but he is part of a group called Bon Iver, which is just a musical group that's now more of a national name. Mm-hmm. And he had a concert here on campus, and all the proceeds went to Bolton Refuge House. So you see, you know, men getting a little bit more involved, and even after their, you know, within their career, bringing it back and still supporting it. So that's what I've noticed, at least. But like I said, I haven't been in the actual classroom to decipher the difference there. Keeping within the women's studies program, how had the program changed during the time that you had been involved with it to the time you left campus or retired?
By the time I left, it was just a given that in most of the academic departments there would be women's studies courses. Whereas, you know, we started out first with just a sociology course, then a couple of years later, the literature course. History came in there someplace, but not early on, and that was a natural for studying women. Mm-hmm. But the research wasn't out there. It's like the professor in the English department saying, well, I would teach some women writers if I knew who they were.
Sure.
And whereas now I think any textbook in whatever field takes into consideration the issues for women.
Mm-hmm.
Women have had this centuries-old tradition, and yet it's just been ignored. For example, quilts, you know, as art, maybe late 70s, museums were starting to recognize.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, it's a given. And you could just run through a whole lot of fields and find that it's accepted.
Sure.
And respected and encouraged. And, but again, in terms of being encouraged, this university, even though they dragged in getting the women's studies courses, as an individual, every grant I applied for, I got backing in. And as I brought two of my books, so just so you can, this is one of them that the university, and this is the last one that I finished after I retired. But I am deeply indebted to the university for the support. And I'm sure as you're talking to other professors, you must find other people who have received a lot of support.
Mm-hmm. So on an individual level, you have that support. But as a group trying to get something, it's a little bit more difficult. Sure. What are the major contributions of the Women's Studies program on campus, to the campus and community? How has the Women's Studies program back then, I guess, helped at all with the larger community off campus?
One important development was Women's Day. Maybe you've come across that. And I think maybe it focused on the sciences, Women's Day in the sciences, which brought, you know, brought connections between faculty and high school teachers, and then bringing in young women for these programs to be thinking about careers and advanced education in the sciences in particular. We've always, in the English department, we've always had a good relationship with the public library. And almost any semester, there would be a group of faculty working with reading groups and lectures at the library. And frequently, those would be on women's issues.
Okay.
One of the things about retiring is I've been able to become more a part of the community than I ever was as an academic. Because as you can see, you know, I was, for those early years, I was raising three sons, I was going to school, I was publishing books, and I did a certain amount in the community, but not much, whereas now I can get out and do stuff at the senior center, after school homework club, working with Hmong students at Locust Lane, you know, those mm-hmm. kinds of things.
Sure.
But I expect there were other faculty members who weren't as committed in terms of publishing who were able to put their energies and their talents into the community to a greater degree than I did.
Sure. Yeah. So more than as women's studies as a whole, going out individuals through having women's studies opening that door of bringing women's issues into educational forms is more how it affected the community.
Well, and I don't have a sense of how extensive that influence was.
Okay.
I can't, other than the Women's Day program, at least during my years.
Sure.
I can't think of, but I'm sure there were other women faculty who were doing things in those areas.
Sure. Okay. What do you consider your major contribution to the success of the program?
Well, perseverance. I think I referred to my personality a little bit earlier. I think, I'll give you an example. The first time I went to Japan to teach, after I'd been there a couple of months, I taught at Sophia University, and one of the faculty members said, you weren't what we expected. I said, well, what did you expect? But they had the stereotype of this aggressive, domineering, overbearing feminist. And I think I was able to develop some of the programs and some of the interests because, while I was, as I said, persevering in this area and deeply committed to it, I didn't antagonize people along the way. And so that's just a personality thing that I think maybe I was able to accomplish things at that stage when feminism was still suspect, that I was able to get a toe in the door. And also, from the first, I was publishing. And, you know, that makes a difference. If if people see on your resume those publications in the academic world, you know, they pay more attention to you. Mm-hmm. And so I had that advantage. And in terms of developing the courses and teaching within women's studies, I had a good background. And my PhD was in American Studies, which cuts across several disciplines. And so in talking to professors in other departments and students in other departments, you know, I had a background where if I'd just been strictly literature, and for someone my age that would be English and American literature, not much world literature, I had a background for talking about what, say, an introductory course in women's studies should be.
Sure.
And so I guess my multidisciplinary interests would have helped to some extent.
Okay. What would you like your legacy in the Women's Studies program to be?
Oh. Yes, I did stick it in. A couple of years ago, maybe you have this information.
A little bit of it.
I don't remember what they said in there my legacy was, but it was very exciting to be part of a growing movement. With the civil rights movement, that was very meaningful and exciting as well. But, you know, I came in the middle of that in the early 1960s, so the movement was well underway. And whereas with the women's studies, I mean, it was such a transformative period. I hope that my commitment to that has made a difference. As far as a specific legacy, well, I've published tons of stuff in terms of two of my books are bibliographies of women writers, and I published a lot in different journals on women's issues. In terms of here at Eau Claire, what would I say my legacy is? I think probably I've been most influential in guiding students' research. You know, for years in the English department, there was no release time for professors to supervise master's theses. You know, you did it on top of everything else. And probably I supervised more master's theses than, you know, and maybe during the 90s than most, put all the rest of the English department together. They did finally start giving faculty release time every now and then for. And so I certainly feel as though with some individual students, I had, I made a contribution in helping them write their thesis and research their topics. And
sure.
That was rewarding.
My last question, as you think about the future, what role do you think the Women's Studies Department will play on the UW-Eau Claire campus, the community, and beyond?
Mm. How many are in the program now?
I do not know. It is small. I do know that. Because if I remember correctly, I want to say 5 graduated last semester, so if that puts it into a perspective.
I think every department, or most departments, need to be vigilant and do careful examination of their curriculum to make sure that women's issues and minority issues and international issues get integrated into as many courses as possible. It's not sufficient to have women's literature and women's history and intro to women's studies. It's got to be integrated so that it touches the lives of all of our undergraduates. And so I have no sense of where we're at this university at this time. But that would be my hope that after these 30 years almost of women's studies on this campus, that there is vigilance in keeping women's issues in the fore in our programs. But I can't assess that because I haven't paid enough attention.
Sure. Is there anything else you might like us to include about either your works, your life, or anything that you've done on campus that I haven't touched on?
I I hope that young faculty are getting the kind of support that I get. And again, I have no sense of, in terms of leave of absence, sabbaticals, research grants, I have no sense of how much is going on there, because it has made a world of difference in my life and my personal satisfaction and in my professional satisfactions. I can't emphasize enough the support that I got from this university, and I hope others are getting that same support.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
All right.
Well.